somewhat to the astronaut's discomfort, I might add.
The Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. Astronauts Aldrin and Armstrong have now been on the lunar surface for 10 hours and 42 minutes. This program is originating in the Apollo News Center in Washington.
A color photograph of the three Apollo 11 astronauts is available in limited supply for our VOA listeners. We will send you one if you write to The Voice of America, Washington, D.C., USA, Box 8108. Citizens of the United States are not eligible.
This is The Voice of America. We'll return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
Congress, which is in recess today to celebrate the Apollo 11 moon landing, will resume work Tuesday on a number of items. The $2,600 million foreign aid bill will go to the House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee for hearings. The Senate will resume hearings on the Nixon administration's proposal to change the Civil Rights Bill. The new law would ban literacy test and state residency requirements in national elections. And a House committee is looking into charges that organized groups are behind some of the university campus disorders. Egyptian and Israeli fighter planes attacked each other's ground positions across the Suez Canal yesterday for the first time since the 1967 war. Egypt said it knocked down 19 Israeli jets. Israel admitted losing two planes and said it shot down five Egyptian aircraft. The battle was touched off by an Israeli commando raid earlier across the canal on an Egyptian fortress. Israel said it held the fort for an hour, but Egypt said it repulsed the Israelis. Casualty reports conflict. Both sides see the fighting as a serious escalation. Reuters news agency quotes Israeli officials in Tel Aviv as saying the ceasefire between Israel and Egypt has become a fiction. 15,000 persons in Londonderry, Northern Ireland, attended the funeral of civil rights leader Samuel Devenny. Mr. Devenny, a Roman Catholic campaigner, died Thursday following a heart attack. The 64-year-old Irish leader suffered an earlier heart attack last May after police arrested him in his home. Northern Ireland's Catholic minority has staged protest actions since last fall against what it terms discrimination by the country's Protestant majority. American air attacks continue against Viet Cong staging areas north of Tai Ninh. The province, which always has been considered a sanctuary of the North Vietnamese forces, is north of Saigon along the Cambodian border. Allied ground forces moved into a bombed sector on Sunday with a 4,000-man armored brigade to survey the damage done to the communist camps by American air attacks. Elsewhere in Vietnam, the lull in fighting continues. President Albert Bernard Bongo of Gabon flew into Paris from Libreville for a round of meetings with President Georges Pompidou and other French officials. He told newsmen on his arrival he had come to resume negotiations on building the Dalinga-Owando Railway. Sierra Leone signed a £300,000 sterling agreement with the United Nations Fund to develop the country's electricity resources. The UN Development Program will provide about three-quarters of the total amount and the Sierra Leone government the rest. The 15-year study will survey the hydroelectric potential in the country's northern province and determine the need for local engineers and technicians. President Philibert Tsiranana of the Malagasy Republic is scheduled to meet with French President Pompidou in Paris tomorrow. West Berlin police say an East German border guard slipped past his fellow guards unnoticed yesterday and fled to the west. The Soviet news agency TASS says Finland's president, Urho Gegonen, will visit the Soviet Union later this month at the Kremlin's invitation. Britain is expected to have 4 nuclear-powered submarines by next year, each capable of firing 16 missiles with nuclear warheads. And Canada is considering installation of a high-speed train to link its major cities of Toronto and Montreal. Initial plans call for the French-designed train to operate a single unit at a time, carrying 80 passengers, at speeds up to 288 kilometers per hour. The train, running on a cushion of air over a concrete track, could make the trip in less than 2 hours. That's the news from the Voice of America. This is Kay Gallant reporting.
This is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. Astronauts Aldrin and Armstrong on the lunar surface now 10 hours and 48 minutes. Geologists have long wondered about the material covering the surface of the moon. Here's how it was described by astronaut Neil Armstrong as he set about performing his first lunar duty, gathering a contingency sample of the lunar surface. VOA's Rhett Turner described the event as he witnessed it on television. The first voice we hear is that of Neil Armstrong.
Yes, the surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the sole and sides of my boot. I only go in a fraction of an inch, maybe an eighth of an inch, but I can see the footprints of my boots and the treads in the fine sandy particles.
Neil, this is Houston. We're copying.
Armstrong said that the surface of the moon was fine and powdery. He is holding on with one hand at all times to the... Now he's just turned loose. He's walking around now.
There seems to be no difficulty in moving around as we suspected. It's even perhaps easier than the simulations of 1/6G that we performed in various simulations on the ground. Absolutely no trouble to walk around.
We can easily see him moving around right near the footpad and the ladder. He's staying just within a few meters.
This engine did not leave a crater of any size. It has about 1 foot clearance on the ground. We're essentially on a very level place here. I can see some evidence of rays emanating from the descent engine, but very insignificant amount. It's quite dark here in the shadow, and a little hard for me to see that I have good footing. I'll work my way over into the sunlight here without looking directly into the sun.
Neil has stepped off. He's gotten his footing on the surface, measured what it's like to walk around on the surface. They're now extending the sample collection bag. It's been lowered on this pulley device, a cord. We cannot see Neil very clearly at this moment because he's in lunar shadow, and the camera is pointing at him, and only reflection from the surface is bouncing off of his suit into this television camera. He's getting the contingency sample now, but he is out of range of the camera. Buzz Aldrin is reporting that is good. He is
okay,
now
okay, the contingency sample is down and it's up sample.
Aldrin is reporting, I believe, there.
It's a little difficult to dig through the crust.
Very interesting. It's a very soft surface, but here and there where I plug with the contingency sample collector, I run into a very hard surface, but it appears to be
cohesive material of the same sort. I'll try to get a rock in here.
A powdery surface that appears to...
A couple.
But when he scoops down just a bit below the surface, he runs into something very hard. Back here on the... In the television picture,
that looks beautiful
from
here, Neil.
It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States. It's different, but it's very pretty out here.
Neil Armstrong picking up that contingency sample as described by VOA's Rhett Turner. Millions of Europeans watched and listened intently as two Apollo 11 astronauts walked upon the surface of the moon just a few short hours ago. For a summary of European reaction to the event, here is VOA's Robert Lodge.
Most Europeans had learned before bedtime that the moonwalk was to occur earlier than scheduled, and then throughout the early morning hours after midnight sat almost entranced in front of television sets. The enthusiasm was unprecedented, as in the ordinarily sedate London Times, which used its largest type for a banner headline. VOA correspondent Norman Gelb has the story from London.
A leading British astronomer has said here he was so awed by man's landing on the moon that he had difficulty finding words to express his admiration. Sir Bernard Lovell, director of the Jodrell Bank Observatory, said, speaking from a scientific point of view, the future has now been revolutionized. Prime Minister Harold Wilson called the landing on the moon's Sea of Tranquility an incredible historic occasion. British television ignored its normal closing time to stay open well into the night to bring reports to millions of homes throughout Britain on the progress of the Apollo 11 mission. The London Daily Mirror said a new era in man's history has now begun. The Daily Mirror said, America, the land of frontiersmen, has opened a new frontier. The science correspondent of the newspaper, The Guardian, said the moon landing was the fulfillment of a dream which men have shared since the beginning of recorded history. This is Norman Gelb in London.
Now to Paris and correspondent John Bew for French reaction to the Apollo moonwalk.
Whereas the LEM touchdown created an explosion of enthusiasm at public viewing points in Paris and in the provinces, the crowds, which were still in the streets despite the late hour in the night, watched the first pictures of the astronauts walking on the moon in an atmosphere of awe-inspired attention. The French TV's commentator in Houston pointed out that President Kennedy, when he sparked the conquest of the moon in 1961, had not foreseen that the whole world would be viewing it on television. Unlike in many other countries, there has been no official comment in France. President Pompidou at the Élysée Palace and General de Gaulle in his residence at Colombey were, however, reported to have followed the event in front of their sets. This is John Bew in Paris.
The Italian reaction is reported now by Robert O. Miller in Rome.
Here in Rome, all is quiet this morning. The very light trickles of normal early morning traffic are cut by one-third. Those who have to work early in the morning are staying home or are in public places watching on television this spectacular sight of two American astronauts walking on the moon. Earlier today, Pope Paul exclaimed, "Glory to God in the highest and peace on earth to men of goodwill." The Pope was watching the television broadcasts on a special color television set installed in the Vatican's observatory at Castel Gandolfo. "Honor to you," Pope Paul continued. "Honor to all those who have made this bold flight possible. Honor to you who are controlling the mission and to you who notified the world of the feat and the hour." Rome newspapers have come out with special editions using the one-word special headlines, which are possible only in the Italian language. And on the lighter side, one Italian has already applied for permission to found a driving school on the moon, and one enterprising restaurant is already featuring a special dessert called Moon Rocks. It is wine-flavored watermelon cubes served in the hollowed-out rind of the watermelon. Robert O. Miller, Voice of America, Rome.
In East Europe, too, the moonwalk was shown live on television almost everywhere, except in Bulgaria and the Soviet Union. The Soviet news agency TASS briefly reported Monday morning that two American astronauts had stepped onto the surface of the moon. In Budapest, the television commentator declared that all Hungarians are excited, adding that there never has been such a sensational television transmission as this. And dispatches from Czechoslovakia say there was unconcealed jubilation in Prague. This is Robert Lodge, VOA European Bureau.
Maybe if you wondered about the intricate tracking system following Apollo 11 and all the previous American space probes. Well, a good example is the NASA Space Satellite Tracking Station on the island of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean. It's typical of this worldwide communications system. It has about 300 workers, both American and Malagasy. VOA's Hank Grady visited the station's communications center to talk with unit manager Chester Reed.
Chet, tell us what you do in the communications center.
In this particular center, we handle all of the data collected from all of the satellites and communicate this information to Goddard. We are the radio frequency link from the air-to-ground communications with the astronauts.
How do you get this information back to the United States, to Goddard Space Flight Center?
Well, this is interesting. We have two routes. First, we have the route via the London circuit, which goes from the site to Tananarive City, Paris, Madrid, Spain, London, and then cable into Washington. Our alternate route, which is from here to the Australia, from Australia to San Francisco, and this goes via the satellite or by cable. This also is our path for our high-speed data, which is of major importance now. It transmits at 2,400 bits per second.
Well, now, all of this sounds like it must take a great deal of time to get the information back to the United States from Madagascar.
No, sir. In most cases, it is near a instantaneous or simultaneous circumstances. We have a delay of approximately 0.6 seconds from here to Washington.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We've been talking with Chester Reed, the technical manager of communications at the NASA Center for Satellite Tracking in Madagascar.
This is Hank Grady, Voice of America, reporting from Madagascar.
We have called on our reporter at the Goddard Space Center near Washington to describe the functions of that vital element in the Apollo communications network. Here's Alan Mellitz.
Voice communication with the astronauts originates at the Houston, Texas Flight Control Center and is then sent to the flyers over conventional commercial satellite circuits connected to antenna sites all over the world. But the important technical information, which must pass between the space explorers and the ground controllers, this comes through the Goddard Center. The vast space communications network involves more than 3 million kilometers of wires. It takes 4,000 people to operate this important network. During the Apollo 11 moon mission, 17 ground communication sites are in use. In addition, four ships at sea outfitted with up to 450 tons of electronic equipment are at strategic locations. And there are several aircraft also built especially to act as virtual flying communication switchboards or relay stations in the sky. While Earth turns on its axis, and while the moon circles Earth, and no matter where the astronauts are, except behind the moon, this communications network stays in constant contact with them. So when you hear an astronaut speak, hear a flight controller answer, and as you watch the television from the moon, it's the people here at the Goddard Space Flight Center and their colleagues around the world that make this possible. For without them and the highly reliable communication system they have devised, there would be no space flight to the moon or anywhere. This is Al Mellitz, Voice of America, at the Goddard Space Flight Center near Washington.
In Italy, Columbia Broadcasting System's Winston Burdett talked about the rationale for space exploration with Professor Bernardo Cacciaporte, head of the Institute of Physics at the University of Pisa, and formerly Italy's member on the Committee of Five Wise Men for the European Space Program.
Professor, for you as a man of science, what in your mind is the most important thing, the justification of the moon landing?
Well, why did Columbus cross the ocean in 1492? He didn't know where he was going to land, whether he would land somewhere, whether he would be able to come back. However, I think everybody believes it was a very good achievement. Now, there has been some criticism in Europe, and also, I think, in the United States, about the advisability of spending so much money for an enterprise like going to the moon, rather than using this money for, solution of more immediate practical problems. Take, for instance, colonization of deserts, better use of possibilities given by humid tropical zones, and so on. Now, I think that these important problems can be solved rather easily because the basic knowledge is known. Scientifically, the problems are known, so it's just a question of taking the decision at the proper time and investing the proper amount of money to solve them. Well, a performance like a trip to the moon is something of a completely different order of magnitude. It opens entirely new areas to research, to knowledge, to science, and so this is, as I said, one of the main aspirations of man, because the difference between man and animal is mainly that he is not just content with food and sleep. He wants to know more about the world in which he's living and the universe to which he is related.
Professor, how would you compare the American achievement with manned capsules with the Russian idea of exploring outer space with automatic explorers?
Well, certainly exploration with automatic explorers is very important. But you know very well that a machine, however perfect it is, cannot do what a man can do. A man has initiative, he has imagination. A machine can only obey and execute orders that are given to it. Take, for example, the case of exploration of the moon. I have here some coins. Here I have five coins of the same type. Here's another coin of a different type. Here's a third coin, telephone coin of a third type. Now, suppose you send an automatic explorer on the moon. You order it to collect three objects on the moon. Probably, if it gets in this point, it will collect three of the same coins. So it gives only one type of information. What would a man do? He would say, well, here is one coin, but I see two other different things. Why shouldn't I take those? So he would certainly take the three different coins and bring three times as much information on the Earth. Now, I think this is very important because a man has imagination, he has initiative, he can also look around and bring down observations that a machine cannot do, although a machine can do some things much quicker than a man and with much more power, but it only obeys to orders. Now, in mentioning this problem of the coins, I still hope that Armstrong and Aldrin will find on the moon something better than Italian coins.
Well, Professor, do you think that this achievement, the American achievement, means, as some claim, that the United States has now achieved definitive primacy in space?
Well, this is a different question to ask. In science, I don't think you can ever say that somebody has achieved definite primacy. United States are certainly now in a position of advance in respect to other countries, but there's no reason to exclude that this advance may be diminished in the future.
The pendulum may swing back and forth.
Certainly it did all through the history of world mankind.
Thank you very, very much, Professor Cacciaporte. This is Winston Burdett, CBS News, Rome.
This is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. The American lunar module, Eagle, has been on the lunar surface some 11 hours and 7 minutes. Two American astronauts began the age of space exploration yesterday when they maneuvered their Apollo 11 lunar landing craft to a smooth landing on the moon. Several hours later, well ahead of schedule, both astronauts left the spacecraft and explored the surface of the moon. John Hammersmith, what should they be doing just about now?
Well, I would have expected them to be getting ready by this time to
go to sleep, Norm, but I've been listening while these tapes were being played. I've been listening to the press conference of the flight controllers who've just come off the last shift, and apparently they've decided to continue taking pictures out the windows, using up film, and they are taking a little longer than the flight plan indicated to get ready to depressurize and to throw out all the things that they won't be needing anymore. So that, as far as I can tell right now, they may have jettisoned that equipment or they may not. I believe that this press conference started about 25 minutes ago, so that my information dates back to about that time.
Perhaps later we can call in Ed Hickey at Houston and get a status report. John, it seemed that depressurization took much longer the first time around than pressuring up again. Why would that be?
I don't really know. They didn't get around to that point in the press conference, and it did seem like it was an agonizingly long time. You would have thought that once the vents were open that the pressure would go down very fast. It did go down very fast, and then it appeared almost to stabilize. But there was still a little residual pressure left, and they opened the hatch, and no harm done.
It seemed that they took a lot of time to inspect the lunar module pads. Was there any concern or surprise regarding the depth that they did sink in the lunar surface?
No, we didn't expect that they would sink in very deeply, Norm. They apparently sank in a depth of about an inch, and actually, judging from the reaction of the astronauts as they were trying to gather samples or dig in, do any kind of digging in below the immediate surface, they appeared to strike a fairly firm subsurface. And judging from the reactions, I would say that the subsurface is somewhat stronger in this location than in the two locations where we landed surveyors that had a digging instrument on them. That, as a matter of fact, Neil Armstrong, when he was pounding with a hammer on a device to take a core sample to some depth, was really whacking away on the top of it, and he commented, he said, "I hope you notice how hard I'm working to get this into the surface." So apparently we have now had indications that the surface is that we've calculated with plenty of conservatism as to the bearing strength of the surface of the moon.
Also, one astronaut reported what appeared to be moisture in one sample.
Well, everybody's eyebrows went up at that, because one of the things that would make it easy to utilize the moon for bases of some sort, either as research bases or as bases for going on to deeper space explorations, is the ability to locate and utilize water. And there have been a number of theories that there may be ice stored in actually ice deposits below the surface. There have been other theories that there is water bound up in rock structures. And I don't think anybody was really thinking too seriously about actually being able to see or to get to moisture as we would recognize it here on Earth. This may have only looked like moisture to him, may have been a difference in coloration or something like that. The core sampler has a cap on it, however, and two samples were taken, so that if it was indeed moisture, we will be able to see it when those cores are opened up back here on Earth.
Well, in that moonwalk, they set up an American flag, deployed scientific instruments, gathered a large number of rock samples, talked to President Nixon by two-way radio, TV, and determined that the moon's 1/6 gravity was no problem for Earthmen on the lunar surface. This program is originating in the Apollo newsroom in Washington. We'll return to our live Voice of America coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
Two American astronauts are back in their spacecraft after leaving the first human footprints on the dusty gray surface of the moon. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin spent more than 2 hours exploring the moon's surface on foot before returning to their lunar lander. Astronaut Armstrong, who was the first person from the planet Earth ever to set foot on another terrestrial body, said as he stepped onto the moon, "That is one small step for man, a giant leap for mankind." The astronauts are now making preparations to leave the moon and rejoin astronaut Michael Collins, who is orbiting 100 kilometers above in the Apollo 11 command ship. But first, they will catch up on some long-delayed rest and become the first men to sleep on the moon. In other world news, Sunday's fighting between Israel and Egypt along the Suez Canal has been termed a very serious escalation by an Egyptian official. American air attacks continue against Viet Cong areas along the Cambodian border, while there still is a lull in ground combat elsewhere in South Vietnam. Mediators from the Organization of American States keep watch over the ceasefire between quarreling Central American neighbors Honduras and El Salvador. And Italian Premier-designate Mariano Rumor continues his search for a coalition cabinet to replace his center-left government that collapsed 2 weeks ago. That's the news from the Voice of America. Kay Gallant reporting.
This is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. As John Hammersmith mentioned a moment ago, there has been a press conference in Houston, and now to correspondent Ed Hickey at Manned Spacecraft Center.
The press conference is going on at this hour, just about to wind up, while the newsmen prepare and Mission Control prepares to watch the hatch open of the lunar module on the surface of the moon when the two astronauts, Armstrong and Aldrin, will throw out some of the baggage that they no longer need. That should be coming up very shortly. But at the press conference, a couple of items that came out of it, I think, of significance that was not known before. One concerned the laser experiment, in which we had heard reports earlier that it had already been used by ground stations, one in California, in sending a laser beam to the experiment that was set up by astronaut Armstrong. Apparently, that was a false report, and that no such activity was reported, and that, but there will be an attempt tomorrow, I understand, on sometime later on Monday, to acquire the to use this experiment. During the press conference, there's obviously the flight controllers, despite the tension and the excitement, have not lost their sense of humor. One newsman asked the space agency people, just where is the lunar module located? And they said, well, we know it's on the moon, and they jokingly said, but they had not yet accurately plotted it, but they will do that. They did say, however, that despite the fact that they don't know exactly where the lunar module is located on the moon, they haven't plotted it that accurately, that it won't influence their takeoff from the moon later Monday. They were also impressed of how easy it was for the astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin to navigate around the moon. In fact, they were rather surprised, and they moved around the moon easier than they anticipated and apparently had no difficulty at all in handling the 1/6 gravity. We are hearing a report now from Mission Control. Let's stand by and pick it up.
2202, over. Roger.
This is a report. We're in touch now with astronaut Michael Collins in the Columbia, the mothership, which is circling the moon at 100 kilometers, and they're reading out some antenna data at the present time, and after this, astronaut Collins is also going to sleep. Mission Control asked Michael Collins if he wanted to go to sleep while his colleagues were walking on the surface of the moon. He said, Lord, no. I want to stay up and see what they're doing. So he's going to be settling down just a little while for 7 hours of sleep. The doctor at the at the news conference said that the physical effects of the crew were just about as expected while they were walking on the moon. Their heartbeats and every respiration were all about what they anticipated. Right now, the question was asked by newsmen of how the LEM looked to the crew. Did they report anything, any anomalies or anything that might be wrong? And the crew reported that it was tilted back at about 4 degrees, but this presented no problem, and that the lunar landing craft had not sunk into the lunar surface more than about a centimeter. Liftoff time, they reported, is scheduled for 17 hours 55, approximately on Monday, and they're just about back on their flight plan that they had planned to do, flight plan that is scheduled for them before they have changed it to get out of onto the lunar surface before taking some sleep.
Ed Hickey?
Yes.
John Hammersmith here. Have you heard anything as to whether they have opened the hatch again to jettison that equipment?
No, John, I haven't. We are waiting for that now. At last report, they said they would be doing so shortly. We expect to have that report any moment, however. They're waiting for it now. As you commented a little earlier, they took a little longer than usual to use up some film and to get themselves situated into the lunar module. And they also took time out for something to eat for their first meal, man's first meal on the lunar surface. What they ate, I just don't know at this moment.
Well, they had quite a good selection of things available to them, Ed. They had bacon squares and peaches and sugar cookies and beef stew and cream of chicken soup and all sorts of goodies.
Well, I would imagine, John, they would probably go for a dinner meal rather than a breakfast meal. I don't know which one they selected. We are standing by, as I mentioned to you, for this. One of the odd things that have come out of this, and as I mentioned, the flight controllers have certainly kept their sense of humor despite the excitement of the day, and it's been a very long one, but they were asked whether sometime earlier in the evening here, all the lights that came on in the spacecraft. Here's another report from Mission Control. Let's listen. Standing by for Mission Control, waiting for...
Roger, we've successfully reacquired high-gain antenna. Unless you have some other traffic with us, I guess we'll bid you a good night.
Well, this again is the Mission Control talking with astronaut Collins in the mothership.
Ed Hickey.
And we'll have reports for you later in the evening. That's it for from Houston at this time.
The first task performed by Neil Armstrong after setting foot on the moon was to scoop up some lunar dust. The result of the examination this dust will receive is one of the major experiments of the mission of Apollo 11. Here with a detailed story is Jack Moyles.
Scientists around the world will see one dream fulfilled when the crew of Apollo 11 returns from its hopefully successful enterprise. Safely tucked away in an insulated container will be some 100 pounds of rock and dust collected from the lunar surface. 150 scientists all over the world will then be able to make detailed studies of the lunar soil in their own laboratories. Their determinations will confirm or explode old theories and undoubtedly create many new ones. It's an exciting prospect for science and eventually for those of us eager to know more of the history of our own planet, its satellite, and the solar system's origin. Geologists, nuclear physicists, chemists, thermal analysts, biologists, and many others interested in examining lunar samples have submitted specific research projects to the National Space Agency. They will have to cool their impatience somewhat. The astronauts and their valuable load will first have to undergo a quarantine period, which for the rock samples will be 45 days. Then the scientists may come to collect them and take them home for extensive laboratory examination. Then, next January, they will all assemble in Houston once again and discuss their findings. But on the whole, there appears little doubt as to what the samples will reveal.
Some information about the present constitution of the moon. We might well get some information about the past history of the moon.
Dr. Samuel Tolansky, professor of optics at the Royal Holloway College in London.
The main thing it will tell us is about the way this lunar rock has evolved, the sort of heat production of this lunar rock, and whether the moon is a dynamic hot body right now, or whether it was in the past, and whether it's gone through igneous, that is, molten, the volcanic episodes, or whether it never has.
Professor John Lubbering, a geologist at the Institute of Advanced Studies of the Australian University at Canberra. The answer to question one, then, to determine the age, composition, and origin of the moon. This leads to the logical further thought of why. Professor of Geochemistry Ted Ringwood, also of the University of Australia in Canberra, answered that one.
The origin of the solar system has been one of the greatest and earliest of the scientific problems which really has confronted mankind. And although I think it would be hoping for too much to expect that the study of this material is going to solve the origin of the solar system, I feel confident that several major problems surrounding its origin may well be cracked if the answers come as we hope they may come. I would definitely say there is a prospect, a good prospect, of being able to understand the way in which the moon formed, and by inference from this, if we can understand problems such as this, I think we're well on the way to a much better understanding of how the entire solar system formed.
From this deduction would flow the next, described by Professor Kuno of Tokyo University.
By knowing the nature and chemical composition of the interior of the moon, then we can correlate this with the known rocks which constitute the interior of the Earth. Then we can infer the origin of the moon and the Earth, and therefore the origin of the solar system, including the origin of the Sun, Mars, Venus, and so on.
To enlarge man's knowledge of his own planet, solar system, and the universe, an aim to which Apollo 11, as part of the American space effort, is dedicated. But, many experts ask, why does this require such an immensely complex mission onto the surface of the moon? Could this research not be done by traditional methods right here on Earth? Australia's Dr. Lubbering expressed this view.
Well, of course, we have had some experience dealing with other extraterrestrial material, like meteorites, in our laboratories here before, but of course, to get a piece of the moon is quite another matter, and this is really a very exciting project for, and a very exciting thought for me personally.
This excitement of discovering something new fires the imagination of the adventurous scientist. In London, our correspondent, Norman Gelb, found that Professor Tolansky viewed the prospects in just that light.
Professor Tolansky, what benefits do you believe will accrue to mankind from the landing on the moon?
Principally scientific. I think we might get some information about the present. We will get some information about the present constitution of the moon. We might well get some information about the past history of the moon. We might learn something about whether, in fact, the moon in the past had an atmosphere or hadn't. We might learn whether the moon in the past had magnetic fields associated with it, as the Earth has. And we shall certainly learn something from the geological constitution of moon material, which might give us a clue to one very old problem. Did the moon rise through accretion of material from outside, or was it hurled off the Earth?
Professor, do you believe that there are any aspects of the moon, any mineral content, any question of the atmosphere itself, which would contribute more than just knowledge to man?
Are you asking me, in fact, whether you think it's a commercially viable proposition, whether it's worth going to the moon to retrieve? Well, if so, I don't think so. The cost of getting to the moon compared to the cost of retrieving materials is very small.
What are the possibilities that the discoveries of the Apollo flight will be much more significant in terms of the future?
Well, I wouldn't have thought so. If you were to ask me what are the major needs of the future for the Earth within the next 300 years, I would have said one or two. One is power, and the other is water, fresh water.
And yet I can't dismiss this impression I have that you're very excited by the Apollo flight.
I am, but I get very excited when I look at a crystal under the microscope. Here, for years, for the last 25 years, I've been publishing work on the structures of diamonds. And I know a lot about diamonds. If I could find moon diamonds, this would excite me enormously. They might be the same. They probably would be different. And this is an exciting scientific... it's an adventure.
An adventure each scientist will pursue in his own way. For example, at the University of Tübingen in Germany, Professor Wolf von Engelhardt is another of the European contingent of researchers. Professor von Engelhardt is a mineralogist involved in optical microscopy. He told VOA's Robert Lodge what he will be looking for.
We think that some of the craters which you see on the lunar surface are produced by the impact of large meteorites. And if such meteorites hit the ground, they produce very high pressures, and these pressures are the origin of phase transformations under the minerals and of mechanical deformations, which can be detected by mineralogical methods.
You mean if you can determine that a certain crater on the moon was caused by a meteorite, it's possible that certain craters here on Earth were caused by similar meteorites?
Yes, because if meteorites come on the surface of the moon, they must also hit the surface of the Earth. On the moon, we have no weathering, we have no water, we have no atmosphere, and so the surface of the moon can tell us something about the early history of the Earth.
Dr. Till Kirstein, physicist at the Max Planck Institute near Heidelberg, does his research in thermal studies on what is called solar wind.
We wanted to analyze the air gases included and absorbed at the lunar material in order to evaluate the influence of the solar wind to determine the age of the lunar rocks and to say something about the thermal history of this material.
Astrophysicist Dr. John Bastin of Queen Mary College in London talks of studies in thermoconductivity.
We are intending to measure the conductivity, the thermal conductivity of the lunar rock, and we are going to do this by making measurements of the far infrared transmission. Of course, we have rough ideas from the measurements which have already been made from the Earth of what this parameter is likely to be, but we cannot be certain, and we may well be in for a very big shock. The very low conductivity, which the moon is known to have, is potentially a very great use in lunar exploration, because it means that we can construct space sites which are thermally insulated against radiation from the sun and also from the zero temperature, or virtually zero temperature, which they suffer during the long lunar nights.
Tokyo's Professor Kuno gave an outline of what the rock samples are expected to look like.
We anticipate that rock which will be brought back will be some kind of rock resembling to some lava flows on the Earth's surface, which we call basalt. So this is based on the preliminary study by Surveyor 5 and Surveyor 6. My study will increase our knowledge about the moon and also about the universe.
This basalt rock might, in the opinion of Dr. Engelhardt, even permit some sort of commercial exploitation.
Maybe we will have some mining on the moon. It's possible. Why not? We know that the rocks on the surface of the moon have a composition which is very similar to the composition of basaltic rocks on Earth. So we can expect on the moon all this ore, so all these minerals, which are typical for basaltic rocks. And this would include, for instance, platinum metals, chromium, titanium, iron, nickel, and perhaps also diamonds.
Asked about such a possibility by correspondent Lodge, mineralogist Dr. Paul Ramdor of the Max Planck Institute, however, doubted the existence of exploitable deposits.
Deposits means enrichment of a distinct element in a larger scale. And so we cannot actually expect that we can mine on the moon. But it is not in any case to preclude.
You would not rule it out.
I will not rule it out now.
I imagine you're quite anxious to see what the astronauts will bring back.
I am extremely interested to see this material, and I like to do my best to give some small bricks for the building of the knowledge of the moon.
There is, of course, one further question to be explored, a crucial one, though many scientists feel it has long been answered in the negative. The question, is there life or even a vestige of life on the moon? Dr. Paul W. Gast of Columbia University, one of the scientists who have set up the testing procedures to be followed at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory at NASA's Houston installation, speculated on the chances of finding any organic matter.
If the samples that we return from the surface of the moon date back to a very early period in the history of the solar system, which is no longer seen on the Earth, then we might indeed get one of these some clues on whether or not water and other organic materials occurred in the early materials that formed the planet. I think that most of us feel that this is a rather slim chance. I mean, there are the processes that we know go on the surface of the moon, impact of meteorites, forming of craters by large objects hitting the surface of the moon, possibly large volumes of volcanic rock have been spread out on the surface of the moon. All of these would tend to destroy any original organic material that might have been there, so that the odds are very much against us. But nevertheless, it's a very important question that we'd like to have some information on, and the techniques that have been developed in the last 2 years are extremely sensitive, so that even a small vestigial amount of organic material would probably be detected by these techniques.
In order to separate the traces of organic matter on the moon from those brought to the moon by the spacecraft, elaborate sensing and checking procedures have been established. Dr. Melvin Calvin, Nobel Prize-winning chemist at the University of California, tells of these elaborate preparations.
We're set up to look for all of the organic compounds that we can find, regardless of their nature, and eventually try to understand how they got there. That's why we have to know what the rocket exhaust is. That's why we have to know what contaminations there are in the rock boxes in which the rocks are returned. That's why we have to know what contaminations there are in the vacuum chamber in which the rock boxes will be opened in Houston. That's why we have to know what the astronaut suit leaks are. All of these things. And they're gradually accumulating that information. We're getting bits and pieces of it. And from the nature, from the architecture of the molecules that we find, it may be possible to decide whether those molecules are the precursors of life or its residues.
In this connection, Dr. Gast highlighted an important factor.
Well, one of the questions that people constantly ask is there any chance that the exhaust from the descent engine or the handling in the Lunar Receiving Laboratory or many other things that the sample will experience will destroy some of, or destroy much of its scientific value? Well, it will destroy certain things, but here's a meteorite sample which has been laying around a museum for tens of years and which was collected over 50 years ago and people didn't realize how sensitive the techniques would be now that we are able to analyze this with. And we still learn a great deal from a rock like this.
Scientists certainly seem agreed that most findings that will result from these first examinations of lunar soil will be predominantly theoretical, even if they cannot all agree on the overall benefits of lunar experimentation. In a discussion in his London study, Dr. John Edgington, a nuclear research scientist at London's Queen Mary College, expressed his philosophy.
The experiments that we can do here on Earth aren't likely to be helped, probably, by getting to the moon, let's put it that way. Let me correct that slightly. There is one aspect in which not only nuclear science, but science in general would benefit greatly. If we land on the moon, and if one can set up some sort of small laboratory there, as indeed is hoped to be done in the first landings, then we'll be able to study radiation from outer space completely unhindered by the presence of the Earth's atmosphere. And this means that rays which at the moment can't get to the Earth because of the presence of the atmosphere will be able to be studied. X-rays and various regions of the electromagnetic spectrum and also cosmic rays will be accessible to study. And it's these sort of forbidden regions of the spectrum which are of extreme interest to people who are trying to discover how the universe evolved. You've heard of the steady state theory of the universe, and you've heard of the Big Bang theory of the universe. These are two conflicting theories which so far we've been unable to resolve on the Earth. And from the Moon, we might be able to resolve these theories. In addition, astronomy is an extremely important subject in that it's advancing very, very rapidly at the moment. New stars, new types of objects are being discovered in the skies, and the study of these will be greatly enhanced by landing on the Moon.
As for any broad social progress through science, Dr. Edgington thinks this.
My own feelings for what they're worth are that it is a question of balancing possible social negative values against definite scientific positive values. A very difficult balancing trick. I would think that we've got so far that we just have to accept that what's been done has been done, and it's a good thing from that point of view.
Dr. Edgington's colleague, John Baston, for his part, was somewhat skeptical of any immediate advantage to man from this venture, but took a more hopeful view of the future.
I think there will be great advantages, but they probably will not be within the next 10 years. Of course, as a scientist, I would be very keen to have telescopes mounted on the moon. I think they would be of great advantage to astronomy in almost all wavelength regions. But this, of course, may not appeal to the average person as being a direct advantage to mankind.
It is Dr. Baston's theory that man is essentially less interested in solving the social problems which face him than he is in adventure, and that this adventurous bent is directed into scientific research, which in turn produces many great scientific discoveries of true benefit to humankind. These he calls spin-off benefits from science.
If, on the other hand, we concentrate on the things that we like doing, providing they are of no obvious harm to people as a whole, then the secondary benefits, I think, are going to be of great advantage. I think of almost every technical advance brings with it benefits to humankind as a whole, which one wouldn't expect. For example, the discovery of X-rays was not a discovery which was made in any biological context, but it has proved of great use in hospitals and in medical research generally. This is the kind of thing, and of course if I could foresee it exactly, I would be a very wise person. I can't foresee exactly what it would be, but I'm just thinking by extrapolation from past history that this is the kind of benefit which the increased technology, which is necessary for the space race, is going to give us.
It will all start with a microscopic examination of a few pinches of dust from the lunar surface. Where it will lead is still a mystery, locked behind doors which these 150 scientists hope to open with their discoveries. This is Jack Moyles, Voice of America, Washington.
This is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin and the Eagle spacecraft have been on the lunar surface 11 hours and 42 minutes. This program is originating in Washington.